Welcome everybody, this is the Office 365 Developer Patterns and Practices webcast. And today we're going to talk about JavaScript and more specifically about the performance considerations. So now that we're moving from the server side to the client side development, we need to still think through how do we cache the data, how do we access the data in SharePoint so that it's efficient from an end user perspective and it's also not causing issues on the server side by hitting the server too fast. My name is Vesa Juvonen. I'm a senior program manager in Office 365, and the main person today talking will be Patrick Rogers. Patrick, you'll do the intros.
Hello, this is Patrick Rogers, consultant with Microsoft. Happy to be back on the program.
Absolutely. Yeah, we did do a one JavaScript session with Patrick earlier, and that was more around generic development models. But then we definitely need to talk about this performance considerations and performance things as well. I'll let actually Patrick just delete the presentation, and then I will be the person asking, in quotes, stupid questions. Take it away, Patrick.
Okay, thanks. Really, as Vesa said at the top, it's still the same kind of considerations from server-side programming, is being as efficient as possible. And I like to equate it to being mindful and really understanding what's going on, what your code is doing, and when. Some of the stuff is, you know, the same as server side. Make the fewest requests possible, retrieve only the information you need, and provide a good page load experience for the users. We'll talk about all these points in a little more detail here shortly. It's also about embracing, you know, asynchronous patterns in the browser. All client-side programming now needs to be and should be asynchronous. It is by nature, just because of the way the web works. And so it's really important to look at those patterns and really understand them and embrace them and use them. We'll talk about caching. You should look at every opportunity to use caching on the client side. And we'll talk about different ways to do that. And finally, we'll talk about considering page views, understanding how much load the pages are getting. So if your page is getting, you know, a tremendous amount of load, you need to think about that and design your page around that. So we'll talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the caching is a super, super important topic to remember. One of the statements what Microsoft, we as a Microsoft said whenever the people are moving to the SharePoint adding model, is that the SharePoint adding model cannot harm SharePoint farm, which isn't actually true if the development is done in the wrong way, because we've seen some really weird implementations. So one of my favorites, just to kind of explain the challenge, was that somebody implemented a polling widget on front of the intranet, which was checking one in every 100th of a second using AJAX, the status of the list, status of the poll on the server side. Which the whole point was that the poll would actually refresh the front page if somebody else is answering to the poll. It was doing the business requirements, but since it was hitting the server in every 100th of a second, times the tens of thousands of users who actually open up the front page, the farm wasn't performing that well. So, and that's where the caching, and absolutely the performance and being mindful is extremely important. So we've seen a lot of challenges around people implementing widgets without understanding the impact for the SharePoint farm.
Yep, absolutely. And a lot of that, I think, is the business, you know, sometimes needing to have communicated back to it, hey, we don't need to update every 100th of a second or even every second, because people probably aren't answering that poll that quickly. Sure. And even if they are, it can't be that critical that it's worth, you know, that the kind of performance impact that would incur, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one point on this one also is that even though we mentioned about the SharePoint farm, people quite often get confused as well. It's cloud, it's Office 365. It's not a SharePoint farm. Well, technically, it is. There's still a SharePoint farm behind of it. Yes, it's a relatively big SharePoint farm, but if you bang the farm too often, and it will actually impact the performance even in Office 365.
Yep, absolutely.
And one point still on what Patrick was saying, it's really about thinking the mindful, the thinking about how often things have to refresh. One of my classic examples is that people who are querying the user profile data for getting user some, let's say, attributes about the user, particular user, how often do those actually change? They don't actually change that often. So the fact that we would cache the user profile data for, let's say, 10 minutes using whatever techniques, or 30 minutes or 1 hour, is that a bad thing or not? That's always debatable. So we really need to think through what are we implementing versus how often do we actually hit the server side.
Yep, absolutely. So let's look a little bit more in detail about the topics around what is my code doing? This is really where you need to, as a developer, understand what am I doing and what impact is that going to have. A lot of this is kind of general JavaScript or browser efficiency, such as limiting the number, total number of JavaScript files in production. For development, it's great to split up the files into very small pieces. Different teams can work on different components, different folks can work on different components. But in production, you can really combine those into, you know, one large file, string them all together, and then, you know, furthermore, you can minimize that file. Those are techniques I think most folks are familiar with, but are always good to mention. And then browser caching. The browsers already will cache files they've downloaded. Again, this is familiar to, I believe, most folks. But what we're going to show a little bit later is an updated loader pattern that enables caching. So what we showed on the last webcast I was on was the loader pattern, and it was using the jQuery get script method, which will actually get a fresh version of the script every time. Great for development, not as good for production, because those scripts, just like your user profile data, really aren't updating that often. Probably just once per release, right? So we're going to look at an updated pattern that allows those files to be cached in the browser. And that applies to all your other files, CSS, JavaScript, images, things like that. Anything that can be cached should, when possible. The next part is only ask for what you need. All of the various server APIs, whether it's the JSON, REST, or even the CSOM on the server side, use the filtering, the selects, and the limits that are available there. Only pull back the fields you need, only pull back the rows you need. And the reason for that is I've seen a lot of implementations that I need to show the 5 latest articles, so I'm going to request the whole list, and then I'll just take the 5 on the client side. Go ahead and let the server do that work. It's going to be more efficient. It's actually going to have less load on the server, ultimately, and you're going to have less work to do on the client. So get back the cleanest data you can from the server when you make your request. It really makes things easier, you know, on all sides.
And one good example of this one is also that, like you said, it might be that you're querying, let's say, all of the news data from a news list or pages list that then you show 5. That's a classic example. Also, the second dimension is really to understand how much data I'm actually querying. One of the examples what we quite recently had was that one of the developers had developed a JSON, or a JavaScript Object Model Access, and it was checking one property in a property bag of the root web in a site collection. But when the code was implemented, it was actually loading all of the property bag values from the property bag of the root web. Well, it doesn't sound like bad, but the reality was that in that particular root web, there was 800 kilobytes of data in a property bag. So essentially, just by checking on one property, it was every single time pulling the 800 kilobytes of data from the server and transforming and sending that back on the client. So really good example of things to understand, that how much data I'm actually querying. Like I said, absolutely use the filtering target on specific topics. Don't assume that if you're assuming just accessing some collection of data, like the property back in a root site of the site collection, that it's a small amount of data, unless you've verified that.
Yep, absolutely. And even if you verify it, stuff like the property bag can absolutely change over time.
Absolutely.
I've seen not necessarily the property bag, but a lot of cases where something would work quite well. I'll use the example of a news app again. That would work quite well, but as you know, over time, the number of articles in the list would increase, And it brings me to a second point is anytime you find yourself requesting and then discarding data on the client side, that is an opportunity to better filter that initial query. It's not always possible, but in most cases I've seen, anytime you're discarding data, and that includes, I've seen a lot of examples where we want to pull articles from a list, and so we'll pull the title and maybe there's a summary field, but the query will actually pull back the article body, all the dates associated with it, the publishing status, and everything else, and all that just gets then thrown away. So you've just wasted the server's time and your client time to throw data away. So only ask for what you need, be as targeted with your queries as possible, is a really great path to efficiency in the code.
Absolutely.
And the last point here is just provide a good user experience. Because we're in this asynchronous world, indicate that things are loading. Provide, everybody's familiar with the various little spinners and little animations. Come up with something clever, use it in your design. And the last piece is understand the order of execution. If, for example, I'm doing some UI modifications, such as hiding a menu or something like that, do those before executing a lot of long-running data queries, for example. Show in that data query panel a loading icon, get your UI modifications out of the way, and then load that data. That way you don't have data loading and then links disappearing and that sort of thing. It becomes this very staggered experience. Really try and make it smooth for the user. Which brings us to everything is asynchronous. Understanding really in this model is understanding not just the linear flow of code, but how it operates and lives in time. So it's, you know, it's very much event-based. If you're familiar on the server side with like on-click handlers and things like that, it's the exact same idea of I don't necessarily know when something's going to happen, but I do know something's going to happen. And the mechanism we have to deal with that is something called promises. jQuery implements a subset of the new standard, the deferreds, that work quite well in most cases. And then there's other external libraries, Qt, WinJS, others, as well as HTML5 in most browsers now has support natively for a promise object. jQuery, I usually use the deferred model in jQuery simply because jQuery I always have laying around. It works great for what I need to do in most cases. But if you don't, these other libraries provide a great option. And the when to use those is anytime there could be a delay, whether you're doing an AJAX request, obviously, you know, that's the most common example. There's going to be some delay. If you're doing a significant amount of DOM manipulation, it's great to provide a, you know, kind of a promise for that and say, when I'm done, you can continue and do something else. That's sort of the jQuery model of stringing things together. And anytime you need to ensure resources are ready. In the sample code, we'll look at loading configuration and things that need to use configuration. That configuration may not be ready, so you can't reference a variable directly. You can't say just .config because the .config may not be loaded. So you need to provide a way to say, here's, you know, I'll let you know when I'm ready, and then I'll provide you the configuration. Understanding that at interplay in time and, you know, the ability to allow things to wait for you to be ready, and then they can operate and do what they need to do.
That feels like actually quite a lot of work, and you need to understand a lot of stuff in the JavaScript as well, right? Or is it something, well, obviously we have samples to show that.
I think it's become quite common. I think a lot of developers are fairly familiar with it at this point. At least certainly the jQuery AJAX is used almost universally at this point. There's other libraries, of course, but the jQuery is kind of the lingua franca for client-side development and DOM manipulation. So most people have used the deferreds in there. So the done and the fail, I think, are pretty familiar. Where it can get complicated, certainly, is starting, you know, stringing those things together, understanding what needs to happen before something else. Maybe you need to request a file, then process the results, then make another call, and then do something once the whole string of things is done, it can start to get really complicated. I frequently just draw little kind of line charts, to understand, okay, the request is going out and coming back and where things are falling. But whatever folks need to do to really kind of understand that asynchronicity and get to using it. And like most things, I found using it, the way to learn it is using it. Just try it out. And, I often will write a bunch of, deferreds and promises and string them all together, and it's not going to work the first time. So it's really sitting down, Fiddler. If you don't use Fiddler, it's a great tool for this kind of work because you can really see the requests, the order they're going out, the exact data that's coming back, etc. So it can take some time, but it'll be worth it in the end.
Yep, makes sense.
And then once you get that data, we talked earlier about the importance of caching. Caching is really key. This is one of the pieces I see most often missed in client-side development, is people are happy to just get the data, use it right then, and then the next time the page loads or whatever, they'll reload all the same data again. There's a lot of examples where you just don't need to do that. News articles certainly aren't changing every 5 minutes, and if they are, somebody can probably wait 5 minutes to see the latest article. User profile data, basically you mentioned that before, another classic example. Those properties, especially things like first and last name, very rarely change. So that stuff, I'll usually cache things like that for up to a day, simply because it just doesn't change generally. So for stuff that does change, you can still use the session storage, which we're all familiar with, the server-side session. There's also a client-side session. It's key value pairs of strings. The way to deal with that is often using the json.stringify method to turn your object graphs into strings for storage. So you can just store them in the session, and that behaves like a session. They're there for the session, and then it's gone once someone closes the browser. One thing to be aware of with the session storage, it's different behavior in different browsers in terms of shared across tabs. So if I have a site open in two tabs, it's the same site, I'm logged in as the same user, check that your session storage is working across tabs. It may or may not be, and the same applies for the local storage. Some browsers have implemented that a little bit differently. So local storage is just like session storage, except it's persistent. So it'll be there when you come back to the session, when you come back to the site, you can store stuff there. The local storage, by default, it doesn't have a timeout mechanism built in. So if there's data that needs to expire, that's something you'll have to create. We'll actually show an example of that in the code. There's also becoming more common is support for local database, which is the ability to store relational data on the client in actual database format, often implemented in SQLite. But there isn't a great standard around this quite yet, but I think it's coming. Most of the modern browsers support it. And so, again, that's a place if maybe it's an accounting firm, something like that, you've got a lot of relational table-style data, local database may be a good option. Check your target browser support, and there's a few differences here and there, but check that out. Great option as well. And as always with all of these, the browsers will have storage limits. So there's a cap on how much you can store in any of these places. The local databases, sometimes you can request lots of storage that will have to be approved, so to speak, by the user. They'll get a prompt. But keep that in mind, as you're designing your caching patterns, what you're caching and how much space it takes up, and as everything, balance that with how long does it take to get it or how frequently it's used. And also keep in mind freshness. None of these things will expire on their own, so you need to manage that in your code.
Actually, on that one, just out of curiosity, we didn't have a cookie mentioned on the slide, and that does, however, has the automatic expiration.
Yes. So you can definitely use cookies as kind of a very classic pre-local storage way to store data. It's also a great way to trigger expiration of your cache data. You could tie it to cookies as another way to implement that. That's not the path we took in the sample, but it's a great way to do it as well. So you can check for the existence of a cookie, and if it's not there, you can use that as your cache expiration. You can also store, of course, simple text data in cookies if that's all you're trying to store. That's a nice cross-browser supported way to do it as well.
Makes sense. I'm an old school developer, so cookies are familiar of my familiar for me. Well, to be fair, a lot of these are as well. But we used to do cookies back in 99 and 2000. So.
Yep. And they're still used because often, I'll have customers that are, let's say, targeting more legacy browsers where some of these newer options just aren't a choice, unfortunately. So
Absolutely.
it'll be going back to cookies, it'll be looking at other options as possible, right? So it's the other way, sometimes you can use the browser file caching and just sort of produce files of JSON results. That's another way to do kind of backdoor caching if these options aren't available. So really for caching, it's if these are available, great, use them. If not, it's going back to some of the more classic scenarios. But all the modern browsers now are supporting these methods, this local storage, local database, session storage APIs. So it's really just when you're dealing with the legacy browsers, IE8, etc. And the final piece we want to talk about real quick is, we've mentioned it a few times, but it's the price of popularity. And the classic scenario, the corporate homepage is set as the default page in everyone's browser. So every time someone opens a browser, they hit that page. That seems like a great, corporate strategy. The real problem with that is if you have these really data heavy or for example, the news piece that pulls back 500 rows to show five, or the widget that's polling everyone 100th of a second, on that homepage, you're going to create just this excessive load on the farm, on the servers, and that's when you're going to start to see performance issues. So really, I'm a big fan of a nice stripped down, clean homepage. And then link out to these more complicated pages, these different features, or on the homepage, use some of the stuff we talked about in the last webcast I did with just the list view web part and your client-side rendering. You've got a lot of options and flexibility there while letting SharePoint handle all the data for you, which is always going to be a little bit more efficient. So a lot of stuff to do on the homepage, but keep your page views in mind because that'll of course impact performance. And then, I always like to mention for dashboard views, things that are really data heavy, that's a great candidate to move out to a provider-hosted app. You can scale those things independently in Azure or in your own data center, or another hosting provider if you want. And really take advantage of the server-side caching and things like that to make those really data-heavy applications scale a lot better than trying to just put them onto a SharePoint page.
That's a good, absolutely a good point. And then, if needed, you can do just as simple as page viewer report to get it integrated in SharePoint. You don't need to have an app part. You don't need to have anything like that. Or it might be a solution or an application which is linked on the front page. So
Yep.
it doesn't have to be kind of a tightly coupled in the SharePoint in that sense.
Yep, absolutely. So here's a couple of resources. The performance caching is some examples of the client-side caching. And then we're actually working to consolidate a lot of the JavaScript samples into a new core.javascript sample that will seek to encompass most of the JavaScript samples we want to present, as well as a single place to kind of grow those samples and add other samples without having them split across you know, multiple projects, so making it a little bit easier for folks to grab a single project, open it up, and really look at the code.
And that's absolutely something what we're planning to do with many of the other PMP samples as well. So looking into consolidation so that people can more easily pull down what's relevant and then start using that. But that's a really, really nice direction where we're heading with the JavaScript as well. But let's see the things in practice. Code.
So let's jump into this and look at a few things. For those of you that watched the last webcast, and I hope that's everybody, we talked about the loader pattern, and this is exactly what we showed last time, renamed, but just using the get script, which we talked about is not cached. So I've produced here another version that just uses caching, so it allows these files to be cached. So you can think of this like the loader is great for development or QA environments, but once you're ready and you go to production, great to use the cached version because these files, again, aren't going to change other than when you do a major release. We talked about, I've kept all these separate because, you know, this is sort of a development, an example. In production, again, it'd be a great idea to consolidate these files into one large file and then minimize that, and that'll shrink the number of downloads required. The other thing I've added, and we'll look real quick at the embedder is here again, the same one we looked at before, but I've added a second script block as an example, and this will handle pages where the minimum download strategy is active. So what we looked at before is the first script up at the top, and the second one down here is for minimum download strategy, or really, even if the minimum download strategy is not active, it'll still work, but it handles those. And that came directly out of a customer experience and learning that this didn't work in the minimum download strategy. So that'll hopefully help folks out with this. And then there's two additional loader files to work with that MDS system. And the two there are just the same thing of getting a script and then getting it cached. So to look through here, there's a core library of commonly used functions. We'll be looking at expanding this over time as needed. One of the things I wanted to show here is we've got a sample method for getting the current user information. And this is using jQuery deferreds. And it's using local caching. So we have a caching module, which we'll look at shortly. But you can see here we're using a classic caching pattern of if we have caching enabled, try and get the thing. If we have the thing, great. We don't need to get it again. We resolve our deferred. If we don't have it, then we need to do a quick get request. And you can see we've tried to select just the fields we want. You can, of course, modify this as needed, but this is just a couple fields that are very commonly needed. And then you can see we come into here, and we're caching this, and we're setting an expiration of 1 day. That's because, in my experience, this stuff doesn't change. In your environment, if this changes more frequently, this is something where, you know, maybe you reduce that expiration to an hour. Even 5 or 10 minutes will make a huge difference in the number of requests, especially if you're loading this on every page load. It's going to save a lot of effort. I've seen a lot of places where there's a requirement to show the display name out of the profile or the preferred name out of the profile. So this is a great way to get that, cache that information, and re-show it only when need be. We're also now going to start creating a formal PNP namespace against the window object. And there's a whole host of other methods in here. You know, that just come from experience and have proved useful. But I want to look here at the configuration. This is another case where we're using the caching, same exact pattern as before, so you can start to see, you know, how the pattern works. We're getting our configuration from a URL that we specify. So this is something, in my case, we've put this in a SharePoint site just as an example. So it's a great way to provide an easy place to edit configuration for your customer or yourself, but while still putting it into your, you know, code here and then caching it as needed. And I've got a little note for you. So if you change your list field names from title and value, you would need to update this little loop here. So let's take a look at the actual caching.
Sorry, Patrick, I need to jump on that one. So that's a really good example of a better approach storing configuration rather than property back entries as an example. So having a custom SharePoint list somewhere with the value and a key and a value and just storing configurations using that model is absolutely more efficient than trying to take advantage, for example, the property backs or so on, because then you might overlap with some out-of-the-box capabilities, and then you might run into random issues.
Yeah, absolutely. I personally am a huge fan of putting stuff not in the property bag. It's impossible to edit through the UI, and it's kind of you have to write some extra code to go see it and also edit it. Storing stuff in a list, then any user with permissions can go view it or update it, and it just, I think, is a much, much cleaner, easier way to do.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So we'll look real quick at the caching. So I stole out of the Modernizer library their storage test. But if you're using the entire Modernizer suite, you can just use that same code here called modernizer.localstorage. I've got a default expiration of 5 minutes. You could change that, obviously, to whatever you want. And the caching class is actually very simple. It's got an add. It's got a get. And you can see here we're using the JSON.parse, and we're testing the expiration ourselves, because again, there's no expiration provided by the local storage. There's a remove, and then there's a method I always like in caching APIs is get or add. Go ahead and handle the logic of if you have it, give it to me, otherwise add it with the key and then give it back to me. So that saves you kind of writing the same common, you know, 6 or 8 lines of code. So there's our key, if we have it, otherwise add it. And then here's where we're creating the object we actually store, is we're taking any JavaScript object and our expiration. If we don't have an expiration, we're going to create the default. And we stick those together and we use the JSON stringify to just turn this whole thing into a string and store it, or return it back as a string ready for storage. At one place, and we'll hit go here shortly to kind of show all this, but a little bit more complex example of some of the deferreds is we've added in here a little bit of a developer dashboard that's extensible. People can call it, do all their client-side logging, but this will actually load asynchronously and generate a dashboard from some remote files. So it's actually doing a get of an HTML fragment, adding that into the body, attaching dynamically some events, and then resolving. So you can see here is one for dumping the local storage. We're using this concept we talked about before of saying ready. So I can't reference the dashboard directly because it might not be created yet. So I'm saying when the dashboard is ready, and this function takes and gets a dashboard object, then I can add my section, and then I can write to my section once the dashboard's ready. So this is that concept of we talked about of everything being asynchronous and giving, you know, the dashboard module itself, you take however much time you need to get ready and you let me know. And that way I don't have to worry about when the dashboard's ready or timing my code or things like that. It'll just work. So I'm just going to hit F5 and we'll look real quick at that developer dashboard and a couple of things. So the way it works, out of the box, you get a little widget down here in the bottom right corner. This is just control with CSS. You can put it at the top right, top left, right in the middle of the screen, whatever you want. But what it opens is this dashboard. And so this correlation ID is the one actually from the page. There's a G_correlation ID variable in SharePoint Online that doesn't exist on premises. And also dumping out the SP page context info object. So this is another object that exists built in on the page that comes from SharePoint. Gives you a lot of great information, including the user login name. That's on online only. Again, that's not on premises actually. But it gives you user ID, all these other things. So there's a lot of information here, speaking of caching, you're already getting that you may not need to make a request to get. The web language, for instance, if you're doing something with that. The other piece here is we're dumping the local storage. So you can see all the local storage values. You can see a whole lot of where SharePoint itself is already storing things in local storage. And then you can see down here, here's our current user info. And then here's our configuration. So we loaded our configuration, we loaded our little logging API URL, and there's the expiration values off to the side for the configuration. So this gives you a view of what's in local storage. And then here's just an example. We've got some UI modifications just showing that any component can log to this dashboard and saying, well, we don't have the create new site link on this page. Let's try the site contents page. You saw our developer dashboard refresh, and you see here, now we've removed the new site link, and it's actually gone, which is always great when our scripts work.
That's pretty cool. That's super cool.
Yeah, so that's our quick example. I'm hoping as we grow this out, people will find some use from the developer dashboard, and really these examples showing these caching patterns as well as these asynchronous patterns, and understanding how to really link these things together and start to chain these things. And as you build those, you are taking a dependency. Obviously, if I'm going to call the dashboard module needs to be loaded. That may or may not be something you want to include for production. But for development, it's great, especially it gives you one spot to kind of load or log all your stuff. And your developers, you can get at it very quickly. Just open that up, check out what's going on in your code. So check out the samples. If you have questions, hit us up on Yammer. Feel free to contribute, grow these samples out, and we'll be looking to add to this, and we'll bring in a lot of the existing stuff in here as well.
And this is already a great start for the like you said, starting to grow the common set of functions, common set of open to functionalities together with the community, which is absolutely what we should be doing, rather than every single time building a new framework or every single time start from scratch, writing the same exact JavaScripts and functions, which is not useful and productive.
Absolutely. I got to say, it's coming a little bit from a place of selfishness, because I have to do that on almost every project, is kind of go back to the old project and get stuff and et cetera. And this will be, hopefully, a nice jump start for everyone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Good. I think it sums up the presentation. We don't have any slides waiting for us anymore. No, this is the demo was actually the last slide. So I think that was highly helpful. And to be fair, like many of the people actually know, I'm not a super JavaScript guy either. So this is super helpful for me to learn the new stuff as well. And it's great that we have Patrick showing and teaching us how to do this stuff as well. But it's a great start to start building the common set of functions. And thank you for Patrick starting this, and thank you for explanation on the topics.
Yep, thanks, Besa. Thanks for having me back on the webcast.
Absolutely. Thank you, everybody, for listening and joining, and hopefully it was useful.
Thanks, all.